I think we all agree this has been a wonderful week for everybody at Mount Madonna Center for our for our 2013 gathering of initiates of Master Kirpal Singh. And now we come to a time that we've really enjoyed in the past. It's where we gather and share our memories of Master. And I'm going to pass around this microphone. Everyone has to use the microphone. And two reasons, so that you can hear, but also we're recording this for those who couldn't be with us on this wonderful time. We also have stories. I have a handful of stories that have been sent in to us by people who couldn't be here. So they have written their memories down, and we will need volunteers to read them for us. Okay, one final question remains. Who goes first? Okay, all right.
The name of this story is called Escorted by the Satguru, Cecilia Kirpal. My name is Kay McKenzie, and I was initiated in the U.S. in 1969. The summer of 1974 was the last trimester of my only and difficult pregnancy. I'd try not to show my anxiety, but I would think, God, you can't do this to me. I can't have a sick child. I was telling God, imagine. Thursday, July 4th, I began losing fluid. I met with my OBGYN, who took x-rays. Soon after, the doctor's office called, asking to see me and my husband. The doctor, directly but kindly, told us that the baby was weak and would not be able to live outside of my body. We were in shock. I remember thinking, how can the world just go on as it has been? Later that weekend, a big gray Florida storm rolled in. The universe in sympathy with my sorrow. Thank you. My mother, also an initiate, called our satsang group leader who wrote Master. We thought a letter would come after the delivery, and we waited. Faithfully, every day my mother came to visit, talk, meditate, read, and fix lunch. The doctor said that such pregnancies rarely went to term, so all would be over soon. There were no support groups back then, and women didn't speak of stillbirths. We still don't, to spare young women. Guilt-filled, I accused myself for many reasons. Guilt is about I, ego. It keeps you circling around the problem, distancing you from the truth. It makes you think your role in things is more important than it is. I did not realize that Master was carrying me all this time and was sparing me much pain. But his grace became clear when I finally realized that this was the only time I had with this child and could commune with her the way we both were, in utero child and pregnant mother. This insight gave solace. The pregnancy did not end early, but on August 5th, my original due date, a letter came from Master, and it said, "Do not worry about what may or may not happen." Oh, that I could have heeded that advice my whole life and now. Master also wrote, "My love to your dear husband." My husband and I unwisely never shared our grief. We each went through this alone, neither of us wanting the other to feel our individual pain. After another 2 weeks, my doctor said it was enough. I entered the hospital on Monday night, August 19th, to be induced midday the next day, August 20th. It was a difficult stillbirth. I knew Master had mitigated our pain and suffering. All was in his hands. The morning of the 21st, I looked in the mirror and saw amazing clarity and brightness in my eyes. I named the baby Cecilia after the patron saint of music and of course Kirpal, the kind, the compassionate. It was in mid-September when my mother told me that Master had died on August 21st. I was astounded, staggered by the sense that this was of great import, though I could not begin to grasp what it all meant, nor can I still. It is too deep for reasoning. Thus, losing the baby was eased by believing Master, leaving his physical body around or during that same time, escorted my Cecilia. During my fear-fraught pregnancy, it never occurred to me that my child would not live, nor did I ever imagine Master would die, though I knew he had been ill. With the occurrence of both, at or nearly at the same time, I knew that all was as it was to be. The experience has strengthened my faith and has at last given me a growing love and devotion for our Master. It has provided me with peace that passeth understanding.
This is from Aaron Stevens. Moments spent in the company of my Master were infinitely more valuable than all the petty treasures of this faithless world. As time passed, a subtle love began to permeate consciousness, profoundly altering all perceptions. A former life seemed but a distant dream. Freed from the influence of alcohol and drugs for 3 years, nothing could remotely compare with the divine intoxication I now experienced. The presence of the Master was a perfume which engulfed all who drew near. The sweetness it awakened far surpassed the pleasures of sense, intellect, accomplishment, or fame. Recently, Master stated, "God is an ocean of intoxication. I was merely sitting on the shore, and while endless waves rolled forward, it was impossible not to be sprayed with some venison from the ocean's edge." Since arriving at the ashram, however, lack of any particular inner progress in meditation dissolved preconceived notions of sudden samadhi in the Master's presence. One morning I had an opportunity to ask him about it in a non-complaining way. "It is due to your attachment to the outer form of the Master," he chuckled and added, "the other will come in due course." Grateful for the promise, I backed out of his chamber and went back to meditate. "Brother, Master wants to see you right away," exclaimed a breathless sevadar who found me saddened on the far side of the ashram a few days later. I ran over to the porch and entered the inner sanctum. "Why are you walking about with such a long face?" Master demanded. I was tongue-tied, unable to respond. "Long face, long face, why the long face?" Startled by his blunt prescience, I struggled for words. "Maharaji, I am running out of funds and have to leave." His mouth dropped open and ample eyebrows raised up incredulously. "What? Don't think of the future and don't think of the past. Make best use of the living present and put in maximum time for meditations. You are a dear child of the Father and are to stay here with me." He pulled from his pocket a big roll of rupee notes and removed the rubber band which held them all together. "If you ever need anything, come directly to me." While thanking him, I declined his kind offer, not wanting to impose. Master then warned, "They're not all saints here, mind that." There was nothing I could hide, for I had imagined that many of the ashram's colorful characters were on some higher plane, and he wanted to disperse me of this fantasy. In a recent satsang, he warned, "The Master is like a cow who loves to give her sweet milk to the calf that comes from a distant pasture, but the ticks living on the udder only drink her blood." I prayed, "Let me be such a calf." Shortly thereafter, $100 money order came unexpectedly from my mother. I timidly approached the Master and asked if I should borrow some money until I could cash the draft in downtown Delhi, as otherwise my pockets were quite empty. He peeled off some notes, asking, "Will this be enough?" and insisted I accept it. I cautiously accepted some rupees and returned the rest. It took a full day of navigating the chaos of downtown, going from bank to bank, before finding an institution that would convert the note into rupees. A day or so later, I proceeded to Master's house, absorbed in the idea of settling my debt, if such were possible. How could a slave of mind hope to repay the Emperor of Hearts? After an anxious wait, he suddenly emerged onto the porch, smiling and greeting. I stammered, "Master, here is the money you kindly loaned me." He chuckled and pushed my hand away. I insisted, but again he refused. As he turned his back, I sneaked the rupees into his coat pocket. But while looking in the opposite direction, he omnisciently caught my hand in his right, suddenly turned and lightly slapped my face 3 times back and forth. He disappeared into the crowd, leaving me stunned, my ears ringing in the impression of his huge beaming countenance in my mind.
My name is John Engel, and here is my story. Sometimes when we sat with the master, we would wonder how someone so great, so knowing, could be at the same time so human and so understanding and compassionate. This is a story that happened at Manav Kendra in the winter of 72, a story that gives a little reflection of Master's greatness. We were all in our 20s, all a bit scruffy and dressed in Indian pajamas, and were sitting with the master in what was to become Manav Kendra Library. Master was talking with us when in walked a Western couple that could not have looked more out of place. The first thing that I noticed was a strong perfume smell. And then I noticed how nervous they looked. The woman had coiffured hair, lots of lipstick, and painted fingernails. The man was in a, probably, expensive suit. As soon as they walked in, Master told us to move back and make room for them. He spoke to them for a moment and then proceeded to initiate them. After the first sitting, I don't remember the specifics, but I do remember that the woman said that Master's radiant form met her as soon as she closed her eyes and led her to a very high experience. The man explained that he had had a terrible pain in his forehead until Master put his hand there. Then he rode up on a high shaft of light, and a radiant figure appeared. But it wasn't the master. He didn't know who it was. Master said something to one of the Indian Sevadars who ran into Master's room and brought back a picture of Baba Sawan Singh. "Yes, yes, yes, that's him," the man explained. "As soon as I saw him, he led me higher and higher." Probably not his exact words, but something like that. They sat for sound. Master spoke to them a bit more, and then they left. I don't remember if Master told us the rest of the story or if it was one of the Sevadars, but it happened like this. The couple were on a trip around the world and had a 3-hour stopover in Delhi. No plans at all to spend any time in India. As the woman walked off the plane, a voice inside her told her to go to Dehradun, find Kirpal Singh, and get initiated. Changing their plans, they made the trip to Manav Kendra. It was in those days a day-long trip. Met the master, and then went back. I don't know if they are people who we all know, or if they never had anything to do with Master and the Sangat again on this plane. I do know that when Master wants to call someone to him, He has his own way of doing it.
The lady had such long fingernails painted red, I thought she was going to injure herself when she sat down for bhajan.
So you were one of those?
Yeah, I was one of those scruffy guys, yeah. Well, I've got the mic, should I just keep going? Okay. I'd been at Mount of Kenner for nearly 2 months, and I hadn't taken a picture of Master. I was an avid photographer and news photographer, and it's a little aggressive. And I just felt it was too disrespectful to take pictures of the Master. It's somewhat too invasive, so I just didn't. And then one day, about the beginning of December, the photographer and assistant set up their gear right by the Mansarovar. And I saw this, and I went up and asked, and they said, "We're taking Master's picture for the 1972 calendar." So I ran back to my room and got my camera, and then when Master came, I thought, well, this is a good opportunity. And I said, "Master, you know, you're having your picture taken anyway. Would it be all right for me to take your picture?" And he said, "Yes, surely." And then he leans over and he says, "But you know, the best pictures are taken candidly." And you know, so I when he said that, I felt like he'd given me permission to to take pictures. I felt more at ease, and I did take some pictures at that time. Is there time for another question? Okay. This got me thinking when Helen read a few days ago about Simran and the, and then we've been hearing the tape about saying the words slowly, maybe at intervals. And one morning at Darshan, somebody asked Master, "So, Master, what do you mean slowly, maybe at intervals? Like, what exactly do you mean? Can you tell us?" So I think we all expect the Master to just, say the words, but here's what he did. He closed his eyes, and he raised his right hand with his fingers, like almost like a baton, like he was going to conduct something. And then he closed his eyes, and then he just slowly, slowly dropped his arm. And then he just sat there, and we waited. And we waited, and we waited, and we waited. and just about when I thought Master, I thought maybe he'd fallen asleep or something, he raised his hand again. And then he slowly, slowly dropped it. And he did that, with his eyes closed, perfectly still otherwise, for the whole five rounds. And I think we were all really astonished that none of us realized how long, that what he really meant by that interval. And it was very, very, very long. Yeah. Okay. A fellow came by Mount of Kendra, a Western fellow, but he was doing the whole sadhu trip. And he had dreadlocks and the dhoti and he'd been traveling through India, and he'd learned this and that and seen this guru and that guru and learned all kinds of rites and rituals and bathed in the Ganges and visited the places of pilgrimage. And I guess he'd heard about the Master and he was passing through, so he stopped in at Mount of Kendra and asked if he could stay a while. And Master said yes. So I got to know him a little bit. He was very knowledgeable about taking care of himself and making yogurt and bread and this and that. And but obviously he was really into this sadhu thing. And so Master went away for maybe a week or so, and he asked us to stay, not to go with him on wherever he was going. I think it was just to Delhi. And when he came back, one of the Sevadars came over to where we were staying and said to this fellow, "Master wants to see you." And he's all bright, he's smiling, "Master wants to see me." So he rushes off to see, to see Master. And I thought, well, here's a chance for a little darshan, I'll just tag along behind him. And so I was, I was 100 feet behind him or so. So Master was at his house, which at that time was the library, which is became the library. He was standing at the top of the stairs. And this fellow came, ran up to the bottom of the stairs and looked up, and Master was angry. Master was furious, absolutely furious. And what apparently happened is that somebody had told the Master that he had gotten naked on the ashram or whatever, maybe doing some ablutions or something, or he had, which I, as far as I know, was not true. But for all intents and purposes, this is what was told to Master, and he was absolutely, he was shaking, he was so angry. And he told the guy to get out of the Manav Kendra, to leave. And I mean, I was 100 feet back, and I caught, if the earth swallowed, opened up and swallowed him, that, I wouldn't have expected anything less. Anyway, so things toned down a little bit, and they actually arranged a car to take him and his belongings to Rishikesh, because Master said that's where he belonged. He belonged with all the other sadhus. So they took him to Rishikesh, and then we didn't hear anything for a few weeks. And a few weeks later, Master's car comes back to Manav Kendra, and there's this fellow, and his hair's cut, and he's wearing Western clothes, and he's very contrite and very, very meek. And and he asked Master for initiation. And so it was just whatever, I mean, he was just a changed person. That's all I can say. Just totally, totally changed. Master had worked on him very hard. But like he always said, that like the potter, when he presses his hand on the outside, there's always the hand on the inside to keep the pot together.
Was anybody else in India in the last part of July and the first and through August at all here? Well, I was hoping to share stories. I arrived July 27th and of 74. I was given permission to come because of my work schedule, and just to take you through some of what our master had planned, and I say planned, for his last month before leaving his physical body. I knew that it was a plan because he was really was showing stress after he had 35,000 people over the weekend for Salman Singh's birthday celebration, followed by initiation of 1,057 people, which was beautiful an initiation. He'd given the charge words in Persian, and they brought out a cot for him, so he, in between times, he would recline on the cot. but he was there for the whole initiation and even for people who didn't have an experience afterwards. He sat and there were people who were seeing his radiant form. There was one man who was covered, talking away to whoever he was obviously talking to Master. Followed by the Monday, the following Monday, speaking to members of Parliament, 100 members of Parliament. He was so proud of that. And that talk, of course, was printed in Sat Sandesh. He was the first spiritual person asked to speak in that Parliament. And this is what he was hoping that would happen again and again throughout the world. His desire was for spiritual people to enter into government policies. Another plan was being made during that time to have another conference in November. And he was part of drawing up that plan because there were one of the parts of the plan that was to take place was about young people around the world who were revolting and needed guidance. So after this, he was dealing with us. There were about 10 of us, and we were in a very tiny group and possibly a break from the intensity that was going on around. And I have in the diary on August 1st a note that Edna had spoken to Master, and he was showing signs of being really tired and sick. And he said to Edna that in 3 weeks he would be all right. That was the 21st, and that's when he left his body. So he knew that he was leaving. None of us did. He seemed to recover. Every day he gave us darshan. Almost every day, maybe skipped a day in between. And those talks are in the His Grace Lives On, which were only cassette tapes at the time. And before I left, he'd given me these tapes, stopped recording, and told me we were doing the Light of Kripal, and he asked how many were left. He was checking each one, and he had checked all but four, and I said, there were only four left. He said, from now on, send Reno Serene in California would be following through with anything that was to be printed. Then he said there would be a long time before another book would come out, and he said that would be only for initiates. There was one incident that was the giving of gifts. Every time somebody came, a Westerner came, they brought either tapes or books or something for Master, for the children at Amount of Kendra. This was a Bible that Master said were the words of God. And then there was a reflexology foot chart. Master opened up the chart. It's a big one. And carefully studied it. and asked if there was a book with it. And he said, there is a book written, but we didn't bring it. And afterwards, Edna said the master was taking massages, and that he, at one point, she told the story about Cuckoo's brother-in-law, who was very, very sick, and Master, he was, apparently he was bleeding and he looked like he was dying. Master sat on the floor and started to work on his feet and found one spot on the bottom of his feet and pressed it. And apparently he did it several times, and we know that he recovered. So so that was one thing.
Before you let Charlene go, mentioned this book.
Well, that was the Is Grace Lives On, which, you know, we put together how many years? 20 years? I mean, years and years afterwards. That's the only thing I could think of, unless there's something else coming up. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to kind of at least complete that thought.
I'll read one. This is from Jack Weinstein. In 1972, Master Kirpal came to South Florida on his third world tour. My mother and I went to be with him at the Galt Ocean Mile Hotel in Fort Lauderdale. There were about 800 people, mostly initiates, in the big auditorium. We sat just about in the middle with about 400 people in front of us. Years before I was initiated, when I would read a spiritual book and see the words, "The power of love," I would stop and think, it must be more than the love you feel for a husband, wife, your children, parents, siblings, and friends. I never could come up with the answer. I never asked Master Kirpal about the deeper meaning of the power of love. But he knew, and by his infinite grace, he gave me an experience of the power of love. Master Kirpal came into the hotel auditorium, went to the middle of the stage, and sat down. He then looked right at me just before he spoke to all of us. Something opened in my chest, and liquid love flowed throughout my body. Liquid, infinite love. I went into a mild ecstasy. I looked at a door, and I loved the door with every fiber of my being. I looked at a window, and I loved the window totally. I looked at an initiate Arab woman that I hated because a couple of months earlier, she had viciously attacked my mother verbally for being Jewish and had made my mother cry. I looked at that same initiate woman and loved her totally with every fiber of my being. I looked at an initiate man that I disliked strongly for various reasons, and I loved him totally with every fiber of my being. I was unable to feel or think a negative thought or emotion. I could only love and forgive, because the power of love was flowing in and through me. My amazing experience lasted about 20 minutes, and then the infinite liquid love no longer flowed and filled me, and I returned to my usual state of being. Master Kirpal gave me this experience of the power of love, and I believe very strongly that by his infinite grace, I will experience that most wonderful power of love when by His infinite mercy, forgiveness, love, and grace, He will bring me home to Sach Khand, where I will permanently experience the power of love, as will, I believe, all of His very blessed initiates. Signed, Master Kripal's very grateful initiate.
This is Steve Grossberg, and I just want to recount a couple memories. Anyway, I was initiated a couple months before the 72 tour and found myself on this tour with a sea of initiates, one small piece going from city to city, and it was quite an experience. But the way I perceived the master actually changed a lot when I had the good fortune in the city of Vancouver to be staying in the hotel on the same floor as master. And even though we were discouraged from hanging around his room, and it was the hall was sort of divided with initiates on one side and one end and master's party on the other, one night I went into the community room, since there wasn't much else to do, found other initiates there, and we were hanging out and talking, and suddenly the master appeared. And I saw Kripal Singh as a completely different being than this just profound, austere man that gave talks that we listened to as hard as we could, one after the other. Here was Kripal with a big smile on his face. There were about 12 or 15 people in the room, and he let every one of them know he was really there for them and smiled and looked at each one. Found a woman there with a very small child and was playing with this young person, and he seemed to be having more fun than any of us, and just became this radiant, jolly being. And I thought, wow, this is Santa Claus. And I think I was very lucky to see this side of him, because really at no other point was I made aware of what a loving, smiling person he really was when he had the opportunity. Another experience I want to relate actually happened over 10 years after Master left the body. And this is no inner experience, don't worry. I had just finished seeing Ajive Singh in Vancouver, and was, back at the airport, found myself alone. And as we all know, whenever any of our programs are over, there's always this sort of feeling of loss of community and being alone. And almost I felt like I wanted to see another initiate. And then two came along. One was Peter Harwood, who I'd known for some time, and the other, a fellow named Steve Arkey, who I hadn't known, but met, and we were reminiscing about the wonderful times we had had on this tour we had just been on. And all of a sudden, walking into this part of the airport, which was very fairly secluded, a number of American Sikhs walked in, followers of Yogi Bhajan. And, which was quite a contrasting group to our lack of care of appearance and et cetera. And they all took off and went into the airport duty-free shop and seemed to be having a great time shopping, and which kind of put me off, and I was like, oh, you can't be critical. Don't think about those guys. And then, and Peter had left by then, so it's just Steve Arkey and I. All of a sudden, marching through was Yogi Bhajan and a small entourage. And as soon as he went by, these other people followed him, and they went into a private dining room. And so Steve Arkey turns to me and says, "Let's have Yogiji remember Kirpal for us." And I immediately was thinking, I don't know if this is a good idea. And Yogi Bhajan was a little notorious for being very hard in criticizing people. And, you know, he seemed a hard man to please. And I thought we might be taking a chance. And I began to worry how I might have to respond to defend my master. But Steve Arkey was full of confidence, so I said, sure, we went in. And Steve explained to, immediately was able to talk to Yogi Bhajan, who was at the head of a long table with about eight of his followers, I'm assuming people who were high up in his organization, there with him. And here come these two scruffy guys, and one of them wants to remember this guru who none of them probably thought twice about. And so it was sort of a suspenseful moment for me. And Steve said that he'd like Yogi Bhajan to remember our master. And there was this very long silence. This is the real pregnant pause. And I can see Yogi Bhajan kind of his wheels turning. And he starts off and says, "You know, I never care much for these gurus." And, you know, I'm thinking, I knew it. But then he said, "But this man was different. He had hundreds of thousands of followers absolutely devoted to him. And he was always the most humble man I have ever known." He said, "I've never seen anyone like him, and I never will again."
This is an excerpt from Amelia Crawford called In His Holy Presence. September 19th, 1972. Eternity was waiting at the Washington, D.C. airport for the arrival of the Master. Then he appears through the door, hands folded. He moves through the crowd so humble, blessing us all. Many people are weeping. That night, Master greeted us at the Vienna Community Center. I have never seen anything so beautiful. His voice, his words, the wave of his hand, the motion of his body as he sways, transcends beauty of any description. I am reduced to nothing but tears. I am home. Master said that we should love one another. If we love God, we will love others. He also said we should put in time for our devotional duties and keep our diaries. He wishes for all of us to progress on the way. He was here to strengthen us on the way, that we are all dear to him, and that he was the most blessed. There was only one of him and so many of us. If we eliminate the I-hood, there is peace. Master has a sense of humor. During one morning meditation, one fellow asks Master, "Should blankets be worn during meditation?" Master said, "Just put your whole attention in the middle. We don't want a religion of blanket wearers." Early on during the trip, I developed a silly girl's desire for some personal recognition from the Master. I knew in my heart it was wrong, because we were receiving so much love and guidance from him. He was giving himself to us. One day, before the arrival of the master for a talk, it was raining very hard. Virginia soils have an abundance of red-orange clay, and a puddle of it was forming at the bottom of the steps Master was going to descend before entering the building. Master got out of the car and was walking slowly toward the top step. Everyone was looking with folded hands at the Master for his darshan. I, however, was looking at the puddle. To my horror, it occurred to me that Master would be walking in this puddle. I hastily looked all around to find someone who had put something down for the Master's holy feet. No one was there with the necessary remedy. As Master reached the top step, attentive to his children, the blanket I was wearing came off my shoulders as if in slow motion, was placed in the mud. I hurried back into the crowd so the Master would not see that it was me. As Master slowly placed his holy foot on the blanket, he looked at it so humbly and with such a sweet look of acceptance. Then he looked right at me with the power of God in his eyes, branding me with the information, and said, through thought transference, it is God who blesses us when we are allowed to serve him. I was overcome with gratitude. Not only did my desire get fulfilled, but in a way so much more meaningful than I could have imagined. Master also taught me something about service, other than what he branded me with, that it is just as important to serve the Master as it is to get his darshan. He also knew my ego might have a field day with this incredible gift. My place is to be grateful for all his gifts. On returning to the hotel, I placed the blanket out on the bed. It was saturated with the color of the clay. At the end of the tour, it was pristine clean. I have never washed it.
Steve was talking about the gaggle of young people who followed Master during the 72 tour, and I was just one of that scraggly gaggle that went around the United States during those weeks. Anyway, we came to Sant Bani. It was October, beautiful October of 72, and I had gotten sick, as I often do when I'm traveling. And I had gotten very sick. And to put it into context, I have to tell you two things. First of all, I hadn't eaten anything in several days because I was sick. And I had been troubled for many years with a, I guess you could call it a food and eating disorder, but it wasn't the type you would normally think of. It was to see a plate of food and experience intense anxiety that you will never get enough. It will not be enough. No matter if it's huge, it will not be enough. And so here I am, I haven't eaten, and I wasn't even thinking of food. But a couple took me into their trailer, an older couple who lived in a trailer in the woods. I didn't know these people, had never met them before. They were an older Polish couple, and they were Holocaust survivors. And they were very loving, and I really, really loved being with these people, with their magical trailer with handmade little rugs and knickknacks and hanging things, and just a total feeling of warmth from them. So anyway, the next day, the Polish couple and I went over to Master's house at Sant Bani, and there were about 25 people in the room for a darshan. They were standing behind me, and Master asked for the cakes to be brought out. And
they weren't regular cakes. They were in these square cake pans, the kind that you might cut the cake into little squares and you lift them out of the pan and eat them that way. So there were two cake pans, and he was working on the first one, and I got myself as close as I could get to him with my hand out like this for the cake. And he gave the cake all around. There were a lot of little squares, to my mind, very much too little were these squares, but they were given out and my hand remained empty. So I thought, oh well, there's another pan. So somebody in the kitchen was furiously cutting the second pan into many more little squares. My younger brother was with me at this time, and he had gotten his square. And so he was sitting right next to me. And so the thing starts over again with Master easily reaching into the pan and taking a square out and handing them out. I think I saw a couple people get two squares, and I hadn't yet gotten my one square. So I was getting very almost interestingly hysterical, not about the food, but about the fact that he wasn't giving me any. It wasn't, for once, it wasn't the food itself. So this went on, and that pan emptied out, and my hand was there. He said, oh, there are crumbs. We should give the crumbs out. I said, well, crumbs are better than nothing, coming from the hand of the master, you know. So he was giving crumbs to people, and I could see some people getting crumbs that had already had a square of cake, and maybe two squares of cake. So I was really getting into quite a state. And every single crumb was given out, and my hand was right in front of him, and nothing was in it. So I kept myself together, and he went in the back room then, and people were happily eating their cake, and they were very silent, and I became hysterical, started to cry hysterically. And my brother said, Margaret, you can have my cake. And somebody else said, well, no, you can have my cake. I said, I don't want your cake. It's not from him. Why would I want your cake? You know, I was getting really worked up. And a long while seemed to go by with people happily chomping on their cakes. And he then came out. And as soon as he came out, I remembered that somebody said, Master does not like shows of emotion. Somebody warned us of that, you know, crying hysterically and things like that. So I immediately stopped crying. And the Polish lady was standing behind me, and she said, oh, Master, this poor soul has been weeping. She has received no cake, and she has been weeping her heart out. And he said, oh. And he said, well, okay. And he went in the back and he got an apple and polished it. You've seen him do this. And he said to me, don't cry. Please don't cry. And he threw the apple to me. So I got the apple. I don't know what that meant at the time. I went around asking people, what did it mean? I don't understand what that meant. And people would say, how could you not understand that? And I'd say, but can you tell me? No, I'm not going to tell you. You should know what that means. And it took me a lot of years to figure out what that meant. End of story. I got the apple, and all they got was cake.
So my whole experience of Master in the physical plane, I was initiated in 66, and heard so many stories from people coming and going from India, and dreamed of going to India and tried to go, but I never could. And so my whole experience of Master was the 72 tour, which had so much packed into it. And yes, I was definitely one of the scruffy riffraff multitudes that was in the way and were very challenging for organizers to deal with, and had a small child that my wife and I were traveling with. And so some of the emotion, like when we heard the tape the other night, some of the emotion of feeling like a person that's in the way, an unwanted person, and that, all the feelings about that on the tour, which would come and go. And I'm sure Master used in our man-making in various ways. And shortly after I started on the tour, we were in New York City, and I was there with my son Simon, who was about a year and a half old. And so we would take turns. And Master, at that time, he was giving the meditation sittings and darshans on the 10th floor of the Hilton in New York. And Master came and went with this large group of important people, like, you know, Reno and Ben Ringel and people who, and Mr. Khanna, and they would be sort of, you know, clearing the way and pushing, getting us out of the way and all those sorts of things. And he was up on the 10th floor. And so I was watching Simon in the lobby of the Hilton Hotel in New York, which was not a satsang space. This was the Hilton Hotel in New York. The 10th floor was where the satsang space was going on. So we were just sort of slightly out of place people in the Hilton, busy lobby of the Hilton Hotel. Shortly after, when the meditation was supposed to start, and Susie was up there in the meditation, and it was supposed to start, I think it was like 9, and this was like 9:15-ish or something like that. And Simon loved watching the people come and go from the elevator. So he toddled up and would watch the people come and go from the elevator. And I was behind him, just sort of keeping an eye on him. And all of a sudden, I think this is a story about Master in the physical plane, but I'm not sure. So I don't know. So I was standing behind him, and all of a sudden, out of the corner, no Ben Ringel, no Mr. Khanna, no Reno Serene, nobody else, Master walks around the corner. And he walked up behind Simon. So Simon is standing here looking at the elevator, and Master is right behind him looking down at Simon. And so he reached down and picked up Simon and turned him around like that and gazed into his eyes for maybe 2 minutes. And Simon was just going, and Master was just looking into his eyes. And Simon was kind of a slightly hyperactive, sort of feisty little kid. And he was just lying there looking at Master's eyes. And then Master put him down and walked away. And while I was experiencing this, I was totally blown away by getting to see Master and how he was giving Simon darshan. But it wasn't until later that I started asking myself the question, how did that happen? And so I asked several people that was in the meditation, so Master must have left the meditation. Did the Master leave them? No. Master was there the whole time. And then the other question in my mind was, well, okay, so maybe I saw the radiant form of the Master. But if so, the radiant form of the Master picked up my son, lifted him 4 feet in the air, and gave him darshan. And then the other interesting thing that didn't occur to me until even later is that this was a really busy hotel lobby. And when I had this experience, my entire attention was on Master. I completely forgot about this hotel lobby or the people that were in this hotel lobby. It was all about Master and Simon. But nobody, then in my memory of these people in this hotel lobby in New York, now, you know, New Yorkers are famous for minding their own business, I suppose, but Nobody remarked on this amazing man with a white turban and beard who came and picked up a child and gazed into his eyes for a really long time in the middle of a busy New York lobby. So I have no answers. And one other story from the tour, a really brief one, and it may not seem like a very amazing story. That happened, by the way, over and over in the tour. I got so much vicarious darshan, it was even better than some of the direct darshan I got with, because Master was always would stop the car and give Simon darshan and stuff. We ran out of funds and could go no further. And by the time we reached L.A., I knew that it was going to be the end of the tour. And I kind of knew that I might never see Master on the physical plane again. And I was feeling really, really desperate for some kind of connection, because I just felt like a nobody in a large crowd of people, and my master was somebody at a distance, and I couldn't. I just was feeling this very intensely, and so we were at Yogi Bhajan's place in this fancy place in Beverly Hills or wherever it was, and Master, probably a bunch of you were there and remember it, and it was slightly odd as an event, but afterward, Master and Yogi Bhajan went, and Yogi Bhajan and some of his party and some of Master's party, and I think they were doing a tour of Yogi Bhajan's place. So my clever little mind thought, he's probably going to go look around, and then he's going to come out this way, and I can, catch some darshan. So I sat down on the concrete, and I told myself I wasn't going to move until Master came back. So I'm not very good at sitting on concrete. But I just sat, and after a while, I started being drawn into meditation and had a meditation experience. And the next thing I knew, and it was probably, guessing, an hour and a half later, because this was not just a little tour, this was a major visit he was having with Yogi Bhajan. There was a hand on my shoulder. And I opened my eyes, and stooping down, looking at me, was Master. And he just said, "Hello." This little querulous kind of voice, he would. And then he walked on. And that hello, I think, has kept me alive for my whole life. It's just like this thread through the labyrinth of life. It's just like I hear that little hello. And I was just overwhelmed with this feeling that Master knew me and Master loved me, and Mr. Khanna gave me a ride home, gave me a huge lecture about how I was too old to be sitting on sidewalks and this kind of unseemly behavior, and it just like I just loved Mr. Khanna and loved it all, and but yeah, it was still a wonderful experience. Simon doesn't have any memory of before the age of 5 or 6, except for one thing. He remembers Master's eyes. And interesting, he's never been initiated, but he's always been a strict vegetarian and has never drunk alcohol or touched drugs or any of those things, and is a very good and virtuous person. And I just wonder, all that care and feeding of his soul is ultimately going to do, but he's...
Sure. This is written by Del M. Cruz. My name at the time of initiation was Del Stack. My brother and father were both initiated in 1955, and my mother and I were initiated in the fall of 1955 in San Francisco by Master Kirpal. I was 6 years old and did not truly understand how fortunate I really was. I remember listening to one of his talks and having an incredible urge to go back to India with him. I was fairly strong-headed, but with his grace, a wonderful peace came over me. I never expressed that to my parents. Physically, he was such a large man, white cotton flowing. He moved so gracefully.
Edward Stack wrote, "Greetings, dear ones. I was initiated in 1955 at the age of 14 with my father in Chicago at the apartment of Olga Donenberg, group leader, who had a lovely apartment on Lakeshore Drive next to Lake Michigan. A number of satsangs were held there during this period of time. Master Kirpal was preparing to sit one day and folded his legs onto a stuffed chair, and he pushed off his shoes, and he said quietly, 'For Mother Earth.' This left a strong impression on me. Madame Hardevi fixed Master's food, and in general, she protected him with a loving iron fist. Dr. Curcio, a fantastic natural hygienic doctor, became a disciple of Master eventually, and was trying to get more fresh and raw food on Master's menus, and I'm not sure how that turned out. I have a feeling the traditional Indian diet won't won out. Dr. Khanna of Washington, D.C. worked tirelessly for Master and worked through the nights with Master many of the times, writing letters and other work. In these early years, I actually got letters back from India when I wrote with questions. I asked 10 years later in Washington, D.C. for permission to marry my wife from Master through Mr. Khanna, and he said, 'Master knew already of this and said, go ahead.' I was always so impressed by Master's stature and how erect he kept himself, like in military spiritual bearing. Very beautiful. Much of the time he wore the white cotton shirts with a blue vest with this type of shirt, and I love that too. My mother, who is 93 years old now, and my younger sister were both also initiated 6 months later. I met Hughes from Kentucky and many group leaders, and the whole environment was full of love and wonder. It was wonderful to hear Master's request for our experiences during our initiations. Very good results for everyone with him. Oh yes, and I was the first one to ask to have Master sign a photo of himself. It created a little bit of a tizzy with the initiates, as no one had done it before and no one knew how he would respond. He lovingly did it for me, some sign of how much he loved us."
This is from Pamela Joy Miller. "Dear brothers and sisters, thank you for asking for stories about Master Kirpal Singh to share with satsangis. For me, it's been a very sweet experience remembering this story, writing it in my head, and feeling the healing power of Master's love. My story takes place at Master's ashram in Old Delhi from November to December of 1973. My husband Bob and I had been initiated by Master Kirpal Singh in 1972 in Vancouver, British Columbia. We had been keeping to the path, meditating regularly, going to satsang, helping to build a local ashram, and saving our money to visit Master in India. Bob and I are no longer married, but are still friends, and I know he also enjoys recounting this story, as he was the principal witness to the experience. Bob and I had arranged to stay at the ashram for a few months, but due to unforeseen political tensions between India, Pakistan, and the United States, our U.S. passports were not accepted, and we were given a 3-week landing pass. Due to these concerns, we had to leave the ashram a few times for a few hours to make official inquiries. We took the liberty to look at a few clothing stalls along the way where white cotton pants and tops of Indian design could be purchased, and many women's shawls were on display. I had in my mind a certain dusty rose pink colored shawl, and though I looked at probably 100 shawls, none were the right one. Keep in mind that many Indian women wear bright colored saris and shawls, and that pink is certainly a favorite color. Nonetheless, going from stall to stall with Bob as my witness, and despite the fact that these shawls were very inexpensive, I could not bring myself to buy one. It may sound odd, but I felt like I would be doing something wrong to buy any but this shawl I could see in my mind's eye. Well, we couldn't extend our 3-week landing permit, and after many precious days with Master and many deep experiences, it was time to leave. We hadn't been in the ashram long enough to know much about what happens when you say you are leaving. We didn't know Master met personally with you. We certainly didn't know Master would give each of us a gift. Beyond any feeling I could have imagined was the overwhelming, breathtaking feeling of Master handing me the dusty rose pink shawl, the exact one I thought I had been looking for. I was 28 then. I am 67 now. Almost 40 years have passed, and though I have not kept to the path as I did then, I have my shawl near me, and I have that moment accessible in my heart. I often have need to call upon that great mystery. Was I longing for a gift already picked out for me, or was my longing being fulfilled by Master? There aren't many mysteries that give such deep satisfaction because you don't know the answer, don't really even want to know. And the pink shawl experience kept alive my inclination to pay attention to messages from my heart. And she adds at the end, should any of you wish to hold the shawl, I live in Victoria, British Columbia, and welcome visitors.
Pam is a friend of mine, and yes, I have worn that shawl. It's pretty good.
All right. You probably all heard these stories that when I was going over to India. But anyway, I got a chance to go, and Master sent the okay, said you can go to India. And I told him that it looked like a wonderful thing he was doing there, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but he said, "You augur well. It's going to be a wonderful occasion, the Unity of Man conference." So I got off the plane, and my baggage got sent to Bangkok. So I didn't have any baggage at all. I just had a little shaving kit. So we get to Master's ashram, and they usher us in, and they told us to leave everything outside. But I couldn't leave my little bag of toiletries. So I had them in a little black bag, and I took it in with me. I'm not leaving this. This is my only stuff. So we got in. As soon as we walked in, Master was laying down in a laying down position on a bench. And Madame Hardevi was there, and I forgot who else was there. But anyway, Master was laying there. And all of a sudden, he leaned over and started to move up. And as he moved up, I got the remembrance of, he looks exactly like a big, giant Buddha. Big, huge thing, and it was immense, standing up, wow, like that. And so I immediately hid the the package behind my back. I said, I didn't want him to see it. It really didn't mean anything after that, you know, so I was seeing Master. And the whole room was flooded with this waves of love or something, you know, it was beautiful, you know, it was just filled the room. And I looked around, and I said, you're not in Kansas anymore. It was just beautiful. And I looked at everyone was just like little fishes in this ocean, and they could see their light, you know, their eyes shining. The master looked out and he said, "Does anyone have any problems, you know?" And I said, "No, master, not one. We don't have any problems." So I never asked him, you know, I never told him that I lost my baggage or anything, you know. So that's my story. Yeah, it did finally. I went to get it, and it was 700 bags inside this big, huge place, and there was my bag on the top there. So.
Okay. This is something from Esther's book, His Grace Lives On. And I think Charlene thought it was appropriate to finish off our evening with this. Time is coming, you see. You people will be away. I will simply be remembering your sweet faces. You may forget me, but I'm afraid I won't be able to forget you. Take the sweet remembrance and go on strong with your meditations. And someone asks, Master, when we come to India and we are in your presence, do we also place a karmic burden on you, an added burden? And Master says, do any of you have children? Do you know when your child comes to you? Do you feel a burden? You are dragged like anything. It is the mother who loves the child first. It is not a burden.
This has been wonderful, folks. Thank you. Good night, everybody. Go jolly.